At its very core, drug science must remain independent. This means we don't accept sponsorships. It's with the support of the drug science community we're able to do this and make the podcast in the first place. If you're able to become a drug science community member and support the show, you too will be supporting the dissemination of evidence-based drug policies. Without you, none of this would be possible. For anybody interested, there's a link in the show notes. Thank you. Hello and welcome to the Drug Science Podcast with me, David Nutt. Here we're bringing together experts and activists for a rational, honest and informed conversation about drugs.
A Fascinate Productions podcast for drug science.
Welcome to another Drug Science Podcast. I'm David Nutt and today my guest is Professor Jerry Stinson. And Jerry is an old friend of mine. We started working together pushing 20 years ago on the government foresight project, Drug Science, Addiction and Drugs. I realised then that he was one of the most knowledgeable people about drugs and drug harm reduction that I've ever met. And so today I'm going to chat with him about his fascinating career and the contrast between the success he had in persuading doctors and politicians around harm reduction with HIV and some of the more interesting challenges he's met more recently trying to persuade people that harm reduction for tobacco is also an equally viable and powerful alternative. So welcome, Jerry.
Oh, hello, David.
Great to be talking to you. And well, why don't you just give the audience a little bit of intro into your background and, you know, the origins of your interest in harm reduction.
Yes, well, it, as you said, predates my interest in tobacco because I first got interested in drugs harm reduction back in the late 1980s, early 1990s, when we were faced with a potential epidemic of HIV infection, in particular amongst people who inject drugs. So I was called in fairly early by the Department of Health to evaluate the new needle exchange schemes because they needed to know, would they attract people, would they work, would they help to drive down prevalence or prevent prevalence of HIV rising. So I suddenly launched into this massive evaluation project with quite political significance. Over the years since then, I suppose I started off as a quizzical external observer, but over the years I suppose I became a card-carrying harm reductionist because I saw the success of drugs harm reduction programs, a success of needle exchange, the success of providing methadone as a clean alternative to heroin, and by extension, preventing overdose and so on. And this is with a population you would think wouldn't be amenable to change. But I think I soon learned that many people want to make changes or are able to make changes if you provide them with the right information, but more importantly, provide them with the tools for doing it. You know, this is long before the government Behavioral Insights Unit and the Nudge Program. We were doing it years ago. You know, you can help people. You can't make people do things. You can help them along in the right direction.
And, of course, the Nudge Unit has become, you know, extremely fashionable, and it's been privatized, and, you know, it's still very close to the Cabinet Office. But how did politicians view your early excursions into opioid harm reduction?
Well, initially, I think people were worried because this was the time of the Thatcher government and people thought that Thatcher's response to AIDS and the drugs would be, you know, restore family values and you shouldn't be doing these sorts of things. But there were some problems, hiccups, but within a few months, there was pretty good acceptance. And I think a lot of that's down to Norman Fowler, who was the Secretary of State for Health at the time, and he quickly was educated in the need for harm reduction. And then we had kind of a decade or more of drugs harm reduction. And when Blair's government came in, it was more an emphasis on drugs and crime. But in effect, it was a continuation of harm reduction because it was saying, OK, people are committing crimes because they're using drugs and getting money to obtain drugs. But if you give them methadone, that's going to drop. So that harm reduction message continues. So I think it was very well accepted, and particularly amongst many public health leaders who became very enamored on drugs harm reduction, and some of them became very enamored on wider drug policy reform, you know, going beyond the sort of hard drugs that I was working on, but to other areas of drug policy. So broadly in the UK, it was an easy ride. It wasn't in many other parts of the world, but we did it well, we did it early, and it was a public health success. We have very low levels of HIV infection amongst people who inject drugs in the UK, only about 100 new cases a year. And still in many parts of the world, you've got thousands of new cases a year. So we did something that was pretty good. And of course, it was wider than that. It was safer sex as well as safer drug use. Mm. And in a way, safer drug use might have got in on the back of safer sex, because of the same sort of concept. So, yeah, we did well. And I think public health did well then, maybe not so much now with tobacco.
But, I mean, it is said, and I quite often say this when I give lectures on the history of drug policy in Britain, that the only time Margaret Thatcher changed her mind was when confronted with the threat of the AIDS epidemic and the need to instigate needle exchange. That she was emotionally opposed to it, being a conservative,
yes.
But she supposedly said, and maybe you were in the room at the time, that if the scientists said if we had to do it, then we should do it. Is there truth in that?
I think there may be a bit. I think also that many politicians became aware that AIDS was no respecter of boundaries, and they could see infections occurring in their families. There's always that element of the personal experience, personal testimony, the personal knowledge is sometimes as important as the science.
So, in fact, what you saw then, Britain actually kind of leading the world in terms of applying what we might call rationality to the problem of harms from particularly opiate drugs, bringing in policies that would prevent the spread of infection, initially HIV and more subsequently, of course, Hep C. And the rest of the world, particularly America, sort of despising us or criticising us and actually sometimes attacking us. And now we're seeing something rather similar. Britain, as I see it, leads the world in terms of tobacco harm reduction, at least in relation to vaping. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the UK would be the best place for anybody who wants to switch from smoking to vaping. And there have been objections and obstacles along the way, but we've been very fortunate in having scientists who are swayed by the evidence, having Public Health England experts who are following the evidence and sometimes not listening to the public health directors who have different views, public health practitioners. And we have the most benign environment for people to switch to safer nicotine products. We've now got around 3.6 million people who are vaping in the UK, 3.6 million adults who are vaping. That's about 6% of the adult population. During the period when e-cigarettes have become more widely available from 2010, 2011 onwards, smoking has begun to plummet. We've had a 25% drop in the prevalence of smoking since 2011, dropping from 20% now down to about 15% or 14% smoking. So you've got this crossover, if you can envisage the graph, where vaping is going up and smoking is coming down. No, that's an association, but it's clear that vaping is playing a key role in people switching away from smoking. So it's been kind of fascinating to watch it and also to wonder why it has happened, because it hasn't been governments or public health experts telling people what to do. I mean, governments sometimes like to tell people what to do, but public health experts like to tell people what to do. But the messaging hasn't come from there. It's been driven by a very different dynamic, which has been good products come in from mainly initially small companies, more latterly tobacco companies got interested in, but we could return to that. So it's good product and consumer choice. So for me, as a kind of a public health expert, it's quite extraordinary to watch this process, because it's being driven by people and products rather than by public health experts. I mean, most of my life, I've been persuading big grant givers, big foundations to give big money to do public health products, projects. We've got to prevent, you know, whatever, AIDS in Russia, we need loads of money to do it. Top-down driven. This hasn't cost the taxpayer anything. It hasn't come from government. It's come from people themselves. And that's fascinating, that here is kind of a people finding a solution to a problem they had. And it's not being driven by the experts. In fact, many of the vapors are very quizzical about the experts because, as you know, there's an awful lot of supposition about how bad vaping can be for you and all the rest of it, and it actually leads to a distrust of expertise. But this is a consumer-driven public health revolution. I call it small p public health without capital P, public without capital H, health.
So there's two or three very interesting elements or themes in what you've just said. But before I get into those, tell me why you... I suppose you'd sorted out the AIDS epidemic and then you wanted another challenge. Is that why you moved into tobacco?
Yes, in a way. But I don't know, around 2010, I left academic work, as you know, sort of early 2000s and went into public health advocacy, promoting drugs harm reduction to international agencies. Got a little bit bored with that because I thought job done or as much as I could do. And I'd hired a lot of people into that arena who came from human rights and they knew much more than me. And I thought they could all do it much better than me. It was time to move on. So around 2010, when I stopped doing that work, I'd heard about e-cigarettes and I thought, well, this is really interesting because up until now, there hasn't really been the harm reduction solution for smoking. The idea had been floated many years before, but the only products which were available were nicotine replacement therapy products, which, as I'll perhaps elaborate later, are a little bit boring, and Swedish snus, oral tobaccos, which are not available in most of Europe. So with the arrival of e-cigarettes, I just thought this is going to be the vehicle because here you have a safer product, a safer version of the drug. And getting the drug safer is very important, as you know, whether it's with an illicit drug or even with alcohol. I mean, we have lots of problems with people drinking alcohol, but at least you know the stuff you drink is pretty safe. You know it's got alcohol in it and you can drink too much of it. But you're not going to die from drinking the bottle of vodka from the corner shop unless it's a fake one. but you know, cleaning up the product seemed to me to be an excellent idea. And about that time, I started to meet people who were vaping. Most of these were very enthusiastic vapers, you know, who are very interested in the different devices and so on. So I started talking to them, understanding what they were doing and why they were doing it.
And so that restored your faith in the rationality of human drug taking, that people want to get pleasure from drugs, but they don't want to be harmed.
Exactly. And I think that we have been somewhat diverted in thinking about what to do about smoking because we've talked about it as highly addictive. And you have that language of addiction and you see those reports that say, you know, that nicotine or smoking is as addictive as heroin. And I bought that for years and years. You know, you one cigarette and you're kind of hooked for life. I've changed my view on that because I don't think addiction is a very helpful concept when it comes to smoking. It becomes less important. And issues like pleasure are important. In fact, smoking doesn't really fit the diagnostic criteria for dependence or addiction. You know, you're not spoiling your life by seeking the drug. You're not getting intoxicated. You're not using a higher dose. And in fact, if you think of addiction as kind of dependence or compulsion plus harms to self or others, if there are no harms to self or others, an interesting question, what you're left with. You're left with a liking for a drug which gives some people pleasure. And nicotine is quite a fascinating drug in that respect.
Yes, I mean, nicotine, I always teach, it's unique as far as I know. It's the only drug that both relaxes you but also improves your cognitive function at the same time. And that, of course, is one of the reasons people are so much enjoy smoking. But, I mean, of course, it is also harmful. I mean, the people who've moved from tobacco to vaping are pretty clear that they want to reduce their risks of, well, particularly of lung cancer and of obstructive airways disease, et cetera. So smoking is not... Smoking is still very harmful, even if it's addictive. It's not addictive, it's still very harmful, yes?
I think a couple of points there. One is, as Mike Russell, UK psychiatrist, said many years ago, people smoke from the nicotine but die from the tar. But as soon as you strip the nicotine away from the harmful constituents, then you're avoiding the serious health issue. So the problem is combustion. Yes. But what you said about nicotine just a bit before that, I find it fascinating because it's, you know, when it's inhaled, it's fast acting, but it's fairly short acting. It's not intoxicant. It's a mild stimulant drug, but it seems to be more than that. It's an interesting mood moderator. It can aid concentration. It can help people relax. It can give a structure to the day, a minor reward, you know, a particular moment in the day. So as you and I well know, you need to avoid sort of pharmacological determinism here. And, you know, there's a social, there's a psychological aspect to it as well. So I talk about social psychopharmacology sometimes, because it's the way people use things which is important to understand it. Effects. And in that respect, nicotine is a very interesting drug. And to emphasize, it's not an intoxicant. So, you know, you strip away the smoke and you're left with the nicotine.
Yeah. And that's all right. I mean, when we did our 20 drug harm analysis, the paper, that was 10 years ago now. I mean, it's certainly one of the big, perhaps the biggest separation of alcohol and nicotine, the sort of two popular legal drugs, was the fact that, you know, people don't crash their cars after smoking a cigarette. They don't beat up their wives. You know, it's much less damaging to other people than alcohol.
Yes, and of course your paper was way ahead of its time. I mean, it was at a time when there was not a lot of information about many of these products, because e-cigarettes were still fairly new, heated tobacco products still under development. And so getting the expert opinion on the relative safety was very important. And your estimate in that paper of being 95% less harmful than smoking has been vindicated by the subsequent tox studies and cell studies and short-term health studies. And it is the same figure that's now used by Public Health England for their estimate of the relative risk of vaping versus smoking. They've arrived at that figure by a different route, but it's a very good way of communicating relative risk across a number of variables, a number of dimensions.
And one of the things I loved from your celebratory talk was the point you made, which is that some of the resistance to vaping seems to come from people who should know better, the health experts. I think you were arguing that it's because they didn't discover it, they find it hard to support. Would that be a reasonable summary of your position?
I think, yes, without being too churlish, I think that this didn't come from medicine. It didn't come from public health. It came from little companies in China. In a way, there was a big question about what the role of medicine or public health might be here, and they weren't in control of it, because, you know, people in experts like to be in control. So I think that's part of the explanation, as in a way, all they could do was to raise concerns and the maybes and the fear and the uncertainty. In fact, I've got a friend who developed a little indicator called the fear and uncertainty and doubt quotient, which was an analysis of papers on vaping, which used words like may or could be or possibly, you know, it's like, rather than the strength of evidence. So there's an uncertain role there. Secondly, people had adopted quite rightly a strong tobacco control messaging over a couple of decades, but that was predominantly what I call sticks. You know, it was cracking down on smokers, cracking down on industry, wanting an end to smoking and seeing an end to the industry. So the mentality was bans. And I think it made it very difficult for people to sort of step a little sideways and look at the carrots rather than the sticks. So it didn't fit with the tobacco control mentality. And third, there was a great fear that this might be, still is a fear, that this might be a tobacco industry plot to keep people addicted or to get new recruits to nicotine addiction. I mean, wrong, in fact, because the tobacco industry is a late comer to this area. But I think there was a fear that this was the tobacco industry trying to make sure that it still had customers. And I think that's a wrong perception. For me, in fact, it holds the potential that the tobacco industry might be transformed.
Yes.
Just in the way that the car industry moves to electric and BP has to move to green energy. So the disruption is there. But those are the elements why people in public health were very challenged by this. And all the more odd, it seemed to me, because as I said earlier in this discussion, that many of these people were very pro-drugs harm reduction, pro-drug policy reform. But this is as though they're wearing a different hat when it comes to tobacco. And they feel it very strongly because tobacco control is not only a science, but it's a social movement. So people really do feel passionate about an end to smoking. But for my mind, they've chosen two elements, demand reduction and supply reduction, at the expense of a third one, which is harm reduction.
Yeah, that's very, very well put. I often been fascinated why there's so much antipathy to smoking and almost none to drinking.
It's, as we talked earlier, I worked in AIDS.
Yes.
Key element there was destigmatization. Yeah. You don't stigmatize populations. You need to bring them in. You need to engage with them. When I started looking at smoking, started reading articles from public health experts who would argue for using stigma to help people. You stigmatize smokers for their own benefit because you stigmatize them and you get their friends to stigmatize them and then they're going to stop. It happens a little bit now with obesity, I think, with sort of fat shaming. But yeah. I couldn't understand this, how public health experts, WHO and others, would talk about the benefits of stigma. So, yeah, it is stigmatized. And, of course, that has a follow-on effect because many vapors, in the early days at least, said, you know, I used to smoke and I was stigmatized. Now I'm vaping, I'm doing the right thing, and I'm still stigmatized, you know.
Yeah, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't.
Yes,
yeah. I want to explore a little bit more the rather clear divide between what's going on in the UK and what's going on in America, where in the UK, when I talk to my American friends and say, well, Public Health England is supportive of vaping and NHS Wales is prescribing vaping to people with tobacco-induced, you know, or cigarette-induced chronic lung disease to stop them having so many episodes of bronchitis, etc. But in America, there seems to be no rationality in this field at all. Do you want to comment on why there's such a huge difference between two countries with essentially the kind of same problems?
It does look odd, but bear in mind the US was always far behind other countries with drugs harm reduction and still is to some extent.
Yes.
It adopted methadone early, but that was in a different era. And that was a concern about Vietnam War veterans returning to the States addicted to heroin and finding a solution to their heroin problems, because many in the US military were addicted to heroin in Vietnam. So methadone came in early. But needle exchange, many of these things have not been popular in the US. So there's an antipathy to harm reduction generally. There is what seems from a European perspective, a very strong preoccupation with kids, the health of US kids. And you know, there are organizations like Mums Against Vapes. You know, and there's been there's been a whole moral panic about youngsters vaping, all misplaced, because in fact, US youngsters are smoking less than ever before with the increase in vaping. So there's second, the regulatory framework in the US has become a mess. The FDA has made a mess of regulating products, whereas in UK and Europe, we moved swiftly to regulate. And thirdly, I think there's a strong, well-funded anti-tobacco social movement and organization. A lot of that money coming from Bloomberg and some from Gates. So Bloomberg, who's personally very much against smoking, has poured a huge amount of money into the US and globally in helping to develop anti-smoking campaigns and organizations. But Bloomberg is also funding organizations which are very much anti-vaping. I mean, Bloomberg put $180 million into a campaign to ban flavors in the US, a huge amount of money. And you see that coming through in the way in which many of the tobacco control organizations are pressuring the US government. So it's a very different climate. And it just seems to me very odd to be sitting here in the UK. We talk about things in quite a pragmatic way. You know, we have hospitals which have vape shops in them. Three NHS hospitals have vape shops inside. It's kind of ordinary stuff. We kind of get on with it. Mm. And yet the US is a very different approach to this, and a damaging approach because of the US influence internationally. So a lot of the rhetoric from the US flows through into other countries.
Well, through the, you know, through the UN and the WHO.
Yes, partly through WHO. The US is not particularly enamored of UN organizations, but mainly through funding of grassroots organizations in other countries. I mean, WHO is another matter because WHO is antipathetic to e-cigarettes and to safer nicotine products. Again, it was a late comer to drugs harm reduction. but you tend to get these units within WHO who dominate the discussion, and that's very much been an anti-smoker, anti-industry.
Yes. Thinking about the comment you made about the complete misrepresentation of youth vaping in America, where you've seen cigarette smoking almost disappear as people have taken up vaping, it seems to me what the Americans have done is they've just redefined vaping as smoking so that they can still kind of pursue their clamor and their almost their hysteria, even though the evidence is showing that tobacco smoking under 21-year-olds is almost disappearing because people are vaping instead.
Yes. It's almost as though vapor madness has replaced reefer madness. Remember those films about reefer?
Yes.
To me, those huge campaigns against marijuana, the reefer madness idea, it's almost as though vaping has replaced that in public discourse. Because at a time now in the US where laws against cannabis and marijuana have been relaxed, and yet people are coming down tough on vaping. So that's one thing to think about, how you get these passions for different problems and different threats to American society.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting, Jerry. Actually, there has to be some madness. There's got to be some behaviour in young people that they can get up
in
arms.
Well, if you look back to rock and roll, hula hoops, the internet, computers, they're all going to wreck US teens' lives. So I'm sorry to be a little bit cynical there, but I mean, there does seem to be an element of that.
But it's okay to send them off to Afghanistan at 18. But
yes, yeah, but by the time they get to 18, yes, exactly. It's moved from being anti-smoking now to being anti-nicotine. So it's a war on nicotine, because these kids will become addicted to nicotine or have a lifetime of enslavement to nicotine. So that's the new discourse. So nicotine is the problem, not
yes.
smoking as it was. So nicotine, we're worried about kids using nicotine.
Yeah, I want to explore that with you a bit now. Then I've seen that happening. You're seeing papers coming out of scientists from top universities saying nicotine is more addictive than crack, and at least in rats anyway, supposedly. And you think, it's funny that, isn't it? It isn't sort of my impression in humans that clearly there's hysteria is being developed around nicotine, and that's happening in the face of quite a lot of data suggesting that nicotine isn't particularly problematic. And I'm particularly thinking of the Swedish data, the snus data, which has been sitting there and gradually accumulating more and more evidence over 20, 30 years, which no one seems to be taking any notice of at all.
Well, the Swedish data on the use of snus is very compelling. Snus is a little, it's ground-up tobacco, but it's mostly sold in a little pouch. And over the last 20 years, snus has driven out smoking in Sweden, also in Norway. In Norway, only 1% of young women now smoke. Smoking has virtually disappeared amongst young women in Norway, but about 14% of them use snus. So there's been this crossover, decline in smoking, rise in the use of snus. In Sweden has the lowest prevalence of smoking in Europe, has the lowest rate of tobacco-related disease in Europe due to snus. And there were lots of scares about snus and possible links with different kinds of cancers, but the epidemiological work going back over 30, 40 years really gives snus, I wouldn't say a clean bill of health, but nearly everything you've tried to look at in terms of a problem seems to disappear when you look at the studies overall. So Sweden is a proof of concept that where there is a safer tobacco product and people want to use it, it'll drive out smoking. Unfortunately, snus is banned in the rest of Europe, mainly due to the UK instituting that within Europe under Edwina Curry.
So I want to explore that, because most people won't know what you did, how you spearheaded the attempt to change that under the Human Rights Act. I want you to tell people about how you tried to use the Human Rights Act to get Europe to change its view on snus.
Your listeners need to understand that in Europe, snus is not legal to sell snus. It is in Sweden, which has an exemption. And all of Europe is covered by the same legislation. Whether the UK will divert from that in future years is difficult to know. So there's a ban on the sale of snus, although the evidence is compelling that it's a much safer product than cigarettes. There was a case brought against the ban by one of the manufacturers, a company called Swedish Match, who have almost the monopoly on making snus in Sweden. And I was working with a consumer group called the New Nicotine Alliance, which was a group promoting alternatives to smoking. And they decided to join the case. And we discovered that under UK court procedure, you could ask to join a case as a third party intervener in the public interest. So we said we had an argument to put into this mix. Swedish Match had a commercial argument, but we had an argument about people who might use or do use snus. The argument we developed was looking at the evidence for the use of snus in Sweden, where it seemed to protect key people against smoking. We argued that people should have a right to a safer product. Smokers shouldn't be denied access to a safer product. So we argued under the European human rights legislation that this was a human rights issue, and not just, as Swedish Match were arguing, a commercial issue. It was sort of fun to do that, going to the UK High Court and then to the European Court of Justice and trying to understand the procedures and so on. But that was knocked back. And I think it was knocked back because the European Court of Justice is mainly dealing with commercial type issues, market type issues. And we should really have taken this to the Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. And that's maybe something we should do in another occasion. But I am convinced. I mean, when I worked on drugs harm reduction, as I said earlier, I hired people working on human rights. So we argued that drugs harm reduction was part of the right to health under international conventions. And that argument was accepted in UN agencies eventually. Not accepted through court process, but through just through some practice and statements and so on. So I sort of taken that argument and applying it here, that you shouldn't deny people a product that might help them avoid an early death.
It would seem a perfectly sensible thing to do. My understanding was the British government was not very supportive of your move, despite the fact that Public Health England is quite supportive of harm reduction.
Yes, I think they were mainly arguing a technical legal point, which comes down to an issue that legislators can make legislation. There's a proportionality argument. They argued that the legislation was proportionate to the issue. They didn't argue it on the kind of the facts and the merits, but more. This is often an argument used in the European Court of Justice, and the Court of Justice generally has to accept it, that there's an area within which legislators can make decisions in when there's uncertainty. So that was the principle that the UK government was trying to pursue, rather than the facts of the arguments that we were presenting.
But you said earlier on that Edwina Curry was rather anti-snus, and
yes.
Now you've got the British government defending an anti-snus position. But presumably Public Health England would be quite pro-snus, wouldn't they?
They've kept a bit quiet. Before Brexit went through, there was a Department of Health position paper on smoking. Uh-huh. And in that, it had a post-Brexit scenario where it said that it would look carefully at deregulating where there might be public health benefits. So there was that commitment pre-Brexit to look again at the regulation of various products. So it's possible that the government, when it's got a few other things, it's got rather a lot to think about at the moment, it's possible that they might look more favourably on snus. And it may be that they also look again at the e-cigarette regulations. But there's so much going on at the moment in health that I don't hold up much hope for that happening in the short run.
Well, I think what we can expect, Gerry, is that in fact, I'm slightly surprised we haven't had it already, the claim that vaping causes COVID-19 deaths yet. But that will undoubtedly come.
It has been. There's a lot of social media stuff about that, you know, that vaping and smoking might lead to COVID-19. And it's still early days to work out. We can't even work out whether smoking is related, because there's a lot of contradictory evidence about smoking and COVID-19. The levels of smoking amongst hospitalized patients in China are lower than you would expect. So why have you got fewer than expected smokers appearing in hospitals? The outcomes seem to be worse. With vaping, there's just no evidence. I mean, one small side interesting issue is that propylene glycol, which is used in e-cigarettes, is one of the four constituents. Years ago, that was used as an environmental disinfectant in hospitals and military establishments. And it's often been speculated that that might have some protective effect against respiratory infections. But that's mere speculation. We just don't know.
So where I was going to, Gerry, was the anti-vaping lobby jump on pretty much anything. And I want to talk a bit now about the E-Valley outbreaks and the hysteria about vaping in relation to those deaths from vitamin E acetate and vaping THC. So would you just tell the audience in your way, tell them about that episode and about your take
on it. Yes, I mean, I've almost forgotten that one because people now talking about COVID, but yes, it's not so long ago. It was only just last year, beginning of this year, that the concern about lung injury and deaths related to the use of e-cigarettes. And there was a lot of confusion and misinformation at the time because a lot of the media coverage and even some of the government, US government coverage, was talking about e-cigarettes. And of course, it eventually turned out that it was people who were vaping cannabis products, which had mixed into them vitamin E acetate. Now, to equate vaping of THC with vaping of nicotine is rather confusing delivery systems with what's being delivered. It's rather like saying if you've got a glass, you could drink water out of it, or you could drink whiskey out of it. So vaping THC products, different devices, they are similar, but they're different devices to e-cigarettes, and you can't vape THC in an e-cigarette. So using the word e-cigarette or vaping conflated an issue here. They should have been alert to the fact that it wasn't vaping of nicotine that was the issue, because the first cases were clusters in the US, and there's something going on. It wasn't across the US, and the outbreak was entirely confined to the US. There haven't been any such deaths reported in other countries. So the FDA should have been, and the CDC should have been alert that there was something odd going on. And eventually they discovered that most of the people who had lung disease linked to vaping had been vaping THC products. Not all of them, but again, when you're interviewing people clinically and you're asking people whether they've been vaping an illegal substance, and I think it counts for people sometimes denying they'd vaped THC. And sometimes the cases weren't verified by tox testing and so on. So this was a false campaign, really, against vaping nicotine e-cigarettes. But it does show you how you can have a sudden panic and people jump on the bandwagon. So a very US-specific incident doesn't happen. The lung injuries and deaths in the US are not attributable to the kind of regulated nicotine vaping products that we have in the UK and in Europe. In fact, as an aside, it's an example of an unregulated THC market in the US.
Absolutely. That should be the message, that if you have an unregulated market and people can sell anything, then you quite likely to sell. Some people are going to get more toxic, yes, and more dangerous compounds. That gets me into this other issue of flavors. You've already touched on the banning of flavors and the campaign against flavors, but most people probably won't understand why this is relevant and might even think it's kind of counterproductive, because if flavors help people stop smoking, then why wouldn't you want flavors? So can you just explain to the audience the American hysteria about flavors, please?
The American hysteria about flavors comes about because many flavors have flavor descriptors or names which seem to appeal to young people, gummy bear or candy floss or whatever. In fact, these are joke names that adult vapors kind of quite like. There are some flavorings that shouldn't be there. Diacetyl shouldn't be there. And cinnamon flavors possibly shouldn't be there. But flavors are very important. Firstly, you have to add flavors, because without flavors, nicotine doesn't taste of much, doesn't taste very nice. To make a tobacco flavor vape, you have to add flavorings that make it taste like tobacco. It's not inherently there. So yes, when you say banned flavors, you ban flavors, be nothing much that people would enjoy. They're important because they help people make the switch, and I think they prevent people relapsing to smoking. So flavors give a choice of experience, and people might use several different flavors over time or during the day. It's rather like if you drink alcohol, you don't just drink one type of alcohol, but they have different choices at different times. They give a wider range of pleasurable experiences. And over time, people don't like the taste of smoking. It's interesting that when people first transition to vaping, they might try tobacco flavor, then they experiment with other flavors. And they kind of like those flavors more than the old taste of smoke. So it does prevent, I think, prevents relapse to smoking. So flavors are important. Given choice of experience, to me, having a range of experiences that people can enjoy makes vaping pleasurable, and it makes stopping smoking pleasurable. Because what you must remember is that if you're a smoker and you're stigmatized, you're feeling bad about it, what can I do? I go to a doctor, I get advice from a doctor, I go to a smoking cessation clinic, they give me nicotine replacement therapy, which is boring and doesn't really work. And I feel more miserable because I'm going through all this difficult stage of trying to move from smoking onto a replacement nicotine product. Whereas moving from smoking to vaping is a pretty seamless transition for many. It doesn't work for everybody. Some people don't find the transition easy, but it's an enjoyable transition from one way of using nicotine to another. You don't feel rotten. It's quite amusing. You can buy interesting flavors. You can buy interesting devices. And I've talked to vapers who said they never intended to quit smoking. You know, they tried vaping and they liked it so much as one day they realized they weren't smoking anymore. So the pleasure element is there. And as I sometimes say, you know, there's a whole hobbyist element to this as well. You know, there are vape fests, there are vaping websites and consumer groups and forums and so on. There are no NRT websites. There are no NRT fests. You know, people say, have you tried the latest from Johnson & Johnson? You know, so there's a, for some vapers, there's a kind of collectivity of spirit which comes about through the shared experience of finding a new way of getting pleasure from nicotine.
And it is interesting, isn't it, how many people move to vaping begin to reduce their nicotine. It's completely counter to the fear that nicotine is addictive, because you'd imagine if you were getting a nicer form of nicotine, you'd take more. But over time, proportion of vapors actually end up using less nicotine.
When the devices were first being developed and evaluated, people, I think, were hoping to replicate the cigarette nicotine hit. You know, the rapid spike of blood nicotine within a few minutes and the gradual tailing off. Both the level of nicotine, but also the rapidity of onset, doesn't seem to happen when people move to vaping. That nicotine spike is an artifact of the 5-minute cigarette, you know, invented in the 1880s. The cigarette, you know, the cigarette as a nicotine inhaling device is both a dirty nicotine delivery product, but also encourages those spikes of nicotine that you go through the day up and down, a bit like a bit parallel to having heroin through the day, you know, up and down,
yes,
up and down.
Yes, yes,
when people move on to vaping, both the blood nicotine levels are not as high as with smoking, but they also don't go up and down during the day so much. There's more, you could say, probably looks a bit more like a methadone.
Yes, yeah, I can see that. Because you can take it anytime you like. You don't have to light them with a cigarette once it's lit. You've got to get it in you, otherwise it's gone out, or
you don't want to throw it away. So you want to get the 5-minute hit. You don't want to waste it. Whereas with vaping, the evidence is that people will sip rather than on nicotine, maybe puff 200 or 300 times a day.
So it's a bit like sipping your coffee rather than swallowing straight down a double espresso. Yeah, okay.
Yes, exactly. So the people will learn a different relationship to nicotine. And that also raises some of these questions about our understanding of nicotine, supposed addiction or dependence. Because as you said, many people over time reduce the amount of nicotine they're using per day, when you might expect it to go in the other direction. So it really does open up some interesting ideas about the understanding of the effects of nicotine and how people are using it.
Well, thank you very much, Jerry. That's been a wonderful tour through this really controversial field. And there's a lot of unanswered questions. I just hope that scientists around the globe are going to listen to this and put their minds to them rather than to put their energies into creating more hysteria against vaping. Mm. Great pleasure talking to you, and thanks for sharing. And I hope to bump into you again soon once this isolation is all over. But please stay well, and thanks again for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure.